From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Thursday, President Obama met with relatives of those killed at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando last Sunday, reprising, as an LA Times headline put it, his role as comforter-in-chief after a mass shooting for the 14th time in his presidency.
So today, once again, as has been true too many times before, I held and hugged grieving family members and parents, and they asked, why does this keep happening? And they pleaded that we do more to stop the carnage. They don't care about the politics. Neither do I.
Nevertheless, soon after the news from Orlando broke, the massacre was almost entirely about politics, a vehicle for numerous agendas, with the media acting as a prism, refracting the event into competing narratives, all vying for attention.
This person is a homophobic terrorist, whatever else he is.
State lawmakers are pointing to the Orlando shooting as a reason to close what they call loopholes in California gun law.
This is not a gun control issue. This is a terrorism issue.
Terrorism, guns, LGBT rights, fraught issues in American politics, brought together by a tragedy of unusual complexity, manifest in the seemingly contradictory identity of the shooter.
Investigators believe Omar Mateen was radicalized in recent years.
While his father says the shootings had nothing to do with religion,
several witnesses also say they chatted with the killer on gay dating apps like Grindr and Jack.
The question of how exactly Mateen related to the LGBT community has shown a bright light on one of the driving questions of the coverage. How is this massacre to be viewed? There's a disjunction between how members of the LGBT community see it and how many in the pundit and political class do, like former Senator Scott Brown.
They were Americans first. I don't identify the people that were murdered as from a particular class of people. I classify them as Americans, and it was an attack against all Americans.
For many in the LGBT community, the bloodshed in the club was just the latest chapter in a long history of violence targeted not at all Americans, but at them. According to the FBI, LGBT people are more likely to be the targets of hate crimes than any other minority group. Rayon Brooks, associate editor of The Village Voice, wrote about his response to Orlando as someone in a position of double jeopardy, a gay Muslim. Rayon, welcome to OTM.
Thank you for having me.
On Sky News last Sunday night, the British Guardian columnist and advocate for LGBT rights, Owen Jones, walked off the set in protest against the presenter's refusal to acknowledge that the Orlando attack was homophobic.
It's not some abstract kind of he just picked a random club out of nowhere. He picked a club because it was full of people he regarded as deviants.
Okay,
That's why he attacked the club.
I think part of the issue is, okay, this is clearly, it's a hate crime. This is an act of terrorism. All accept it. It was an attack on gay people. Absolutely. It's horrific. However, my guess is this man probably would be as horrified by me as a gobby woman as he would. Genuinely, this is the thing. We don't know right now. We can speculate, but we don't know. We don't know how much.
So one of the things that was so striking was that he pointed to the presenter and said, "You don't know because you're not gay. Gay history is not taught in schools." So you end up with people thinking that this is the first time a bunch of people have died because of homophobia, when in fact, there's actually a pretty deep history of it. So it becomes sort of this facile argument of, well, all lives matter. It's not just because they were gay. It's because they were American. And what's inside that word American is violence against LGBTQ people.
And that actually tracks very much with the argument over Black Lives Matter and all lives matter, insofar as that people who object to all lives matter aren't objecting to the notion that everybody's life matters, but that when a Black person is killed in America, less attention is paid.
That's right.
And in the case of LGBT people, they are the number one murdered minority group in the country.
That's right. And 80% of LGBT people who are murdered are people of color.
Mm-hmm. You also talk about liberal pinkwashing,
mm-hmm.
though.
Yeah, over the last 15 or so years, the one thing that has swallowed the rest of the concerns that face the LGBT community, particularly trans rights, is marriage equality. And even before United States v. Windsor that made it the law of the land, there was this tendency to think that it was possible that we could have a statutory remedy for homophobia, which on its face as a gay person seems impossible. So stuffed into a broader narrative about American exceptionalism, look at us, how well we treat our gay people. Don't you want gay people in other parts of the world to have the kind of freedom that you have here? It drapes American intervention elsewhere with a kind of moral purpose.
Particularly, would you say, in the Middle East?
Yes. I mean, if you ask a random person on the street which ISIS videos they've seen the most, it's probably the one where they're dropping gay men off the top of a roof of a building. That's the one that seems to have even made it onto primetime news. Right after Orlando, I saw a tweet from Joe Walsh, who's I guess a shock jock in Chicago. I personally never listened to his show, but it came up in my news feed that he believed that all Islam wants gay people dead. And I responded to his tweet and said, as a gay Muslim, I would beg to differ. And the tweet went viral. And the largest group of people that responded to me were people who were saying things like, well, if you're so upset, why don't you just move back to your country where you'll be hanged or set on fire or beheaded or thrown off a building, because we've licked that problem here.
And you also heard from Muslims.
Yeah. A lot of them were openly homophobic. The homophobia, though, had this tinge of, if you are a Muslim, it is definitionally impossible that you are gay. In the aftermath of the shooting, there has been this eruption of queer Muslim people speaking out. I mean, when I outed myself on Twitter, my inbox exploded. One thing that was common among the gay Muslims who reached out to me was they felt like they were really trapped in between a rock and a hard place. They didn't know how to both mourn the dozens of people who had died in Orlando while asserting a basic humanity of one guy and not lay his crime at the feet of all Muslims.
How does it feel to be out? Do you feel a sense of relief or foreboding?
It feels different than when I came out as gay, or when after 9/11 happened, people would ask if I was Muslim and I had to say yes and those stares. You know, there's something qualitatively different.
So this isn't the first time you've come out?
No.
Did you grow up here? Were you born here?
I was, yeah. Okay. I was born in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And I was living in Virginia, not far from the Pentagon.
And how old were you during 9/11?
I was 11 that day.
Did you feel uncomfortably Muslim at that point?
I did. You know, there was a kid whose name was Osama, and his parents, the day after, had his name changed to Sam. I think the threat of violence was common to both the experience of coming out as Muslim and coming out as gay.
So when you came out on Twitter Sunday, what was different about that?
I was doing something political. It wasn't about self-actualizing. It was about making myself visible enough so that it would interrupt the craziness that was happening all over social media and get people to stop and think. I'm sorry it had to happen this way, but one of the really beautiful things that's come out of all of this is that queer Muslims are finding one another, and we are connecting, and we are talking, and we are trying to figure out the way forward.
U.S. politicians condemn a hate crime in Orlando as foreign and anti-Western.
That's right.
But just last year, Ted Cruz gratefully accepted the endorsement of a pastor who had just called for the execution of a gay man.
The sort of profound hypocrisy of that is really frightening. I mean, Mitt Romney gets to look good by putting out his thoughts and prayers for the people of Orlando when he himself has said on the record that he condemns homosexuality. I mean, if you look at Pam Bondi, the Florida attorney general that Anderson Cooper took to task on live TV.
I saw you the other day saying that anyone who attacks the LGBT community, our LGBT community, you said, will be gone after with the full extent of the law.
Exactly right.
I talked to a lot of gay and lesbian people here yesterday who are not fans of yours and who said that they thought you were being a hypocrite, that you've basically gone after gay people, said that in court that gay people, simply by fighting for marriage equality, were trying to do harm to the people of Florida, to induce public harm, I believe was the term you used, in court. Do you really think you're a champion of the gay community?
Pam Bondi's response to the tragedy is as cynical as the rest of the Republican Party's, not bringing up the fact that this was a homophobic hate crime, even as they say, we send our thoughts and prayers out to these families, is sort of just another way of folding the tragedy that befell these LGBTQ people into an anti-terror narrative.
So the focus is still on terrorism. Well, let me ask you about the motivations of this guy. Recently, unverified reports suggested the killer frequented the club Pulse and that he was on Grindr. You've seen the narrative of the killer as closeted, maybe self-hating.
Yeah. I guess I don't really know what to do with that information. I think there's lots of different ways of talking about it, one of which is that his self-hate pushed him to do all this stuff, which, depending on which mouth it's coming out of, could be either sympathetic or just used as evidence for, like, the pathology of homosexuality. If that's the case, then it's further evidence of the way that LGBTQ people are thought to think of themselves. And maybe we should be thinking about what role that played in the Orlando massacre.
So what did you want your column to communicate to people? You pretty much concluded, and I'll quote from your column, "What results from this noxious brew of misread history and flawed assumptions, liberal self-congratulations, LGBTQ political complacency, past and present colonial statecraft, is Orlando. People like me were massacred for who they were, and people like me get blamed for it because of who they are. And neither side realizes it's being played against the other."
I wanted people to understand that the conversation that we have afterwards about the reasons behind these shootings, the reasons themselves might actually have a deeper cause to them, that we can't just make it this facile kind of binary thing.
As in, it's either terror or it's a hate crime?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, those two things can be true at the same time. And I wanted people to understand from my personal experience of living on both sides of that divide that foreclosing the possibility that both of those things can't be true hurts people.
What do you wish had emerged out of this tragedy?
There have actually been examples, I think, of some things that are really important that have come out. There's a list in the New York Times of some high-profile attacks made on gay bars that very quietly made the point that this is not the first time that this has happened here, and that if you're blaming this on terrorists, you actually also have to look at the people who did those other attacks, why they did it too, not just write off the fact that it could be a homophobic reaction as opposed to ISIS infiltration. I guess on the other side, there's been a lot of coverage or column inches given over to Muslims themselves so that they can talk out loud about both the problem of homophobia in the U.S. as well as homophobia in the Muslim world and why we as a community have been silent on the point. I think you can see these glimmers of it. I mean, it feels new. It feels like progress. It does. And what I wrote was, in its own way, trying to encourage more of that.
Rayon, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Rayon Brooks is an associate editor at The Village Voice. Much of the fallout after Orlando has fixed on political language. Nowhere more than on the endless debate over whether to call such an attack an act of, quote, radical Islam. Donald Trump.
What happened yesterday will happen many times over with a president like Obama that doesn't even want to use the term radical Islamic terrorism. Yep. He doesn't want to use the term. And Clinton won't use it either.
Hillary Clinton.
From my perspective, it matters what we do, not what we say. And to me, radical jihadism, radical Islamism, I think they mean the same thing. I'm happy to say either, but that's not the point.
President Obama.
There's no magic to the phrase radical Islam. It's a political talking point. It's not a strategy. Not once has an advisor of mine said, man, if we really use that phrase, we're going to turn this whole thing around. Not once.
Mark Lynch is a professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University and author of the book, The New Arab Wars. Mark, welcome back.
It's great to be back.
does it really matter if we say radical Islam? Does it matter if we don't?
It really doesn't matter all that much in terms of how we go about fighting a campaign against terrorism at the practical level. But by talking about Islam, you then don't have to talk about other kinds of issues. In a sense, what you're doing is you're feeding into this narrative of this being something about the West against Islam, this clash of civilizations, which actually does feed very much into the narrative of precisely the radical and extremist groups that we're trying to contain.
Okay, let's talk about the endless recurrence of the clash of civilizations, as you call it. Is there a clash of civilizations?
For groups like Al-Qaeda or for the Islamic State, virtually everything they do is designed to bring one into being. And the fundamental problem these extremists have always had is that the vast majority of the Muslims of the world simply don't agree with them. You know, the vast majority of the Muslims of the world are part of a common civilization. They reject violence and reject extremism. And yet, what the terrorism is designed to do is to polarize, to drive these wedges so that these Muslims caught in the middle are left with no choice. They might want to coexist with the world, but the world rejects them. Terrorism is very much about trying to eliminate that middle ground and kind of force people to choose sides.
This time around, have you found that the president has moved a little closer to Hillary Clinton's position that this is basically just a distraction?
I think more interesting than whether Obama and Clinton are moving together is the really remarkable fact that polling after Orlando seems to show that there's pretty widespread approval for the position that President Obama and Secretary Clinton are taking, and a pretty overwhelming rejection of Donald Trump's position. We've always had this sense that by pandering to the public, you would actually win support. Instead, you seem to be getting a backlash where people are listening to this and they're putting it into the context of this call for a ban on Muslim immigration, and they seem to be rejecting it.
You told us after last year's attacks in Paris that you felt as if the American people were in some ways regressing, that we were erasing certain gains in public discourse that it seemed that we'd made since 9/11 when President George W. Bush was visiting mosques and so on. Do you still feel that way?
So on the one hand, this poll showing widespread rejection of Trump's position after Orlando is a very good sign, but it's just one poll. On the other side, there really has been this mainstreaming of ideas about Islam, which would have been very much on the fringe in the past and now seem to be increasingly accepted.
How do you know these are being mainstreamed? I know that the digital media gives ample opportunity for groups that once hid in the shadows, whether they're violently inclined jihadists or white supremacists, to get together as if at the corner bar and hatch their plans. But do we know for a fact that the ideas have mainstreamed?
I think for many people, the Trump campaign, and not just Trump, but the entire Republican primary, was evidence of the mainstreaming of these ideas, where almost every candidate seemed to be endorsing many of the same ideas about Islam and about immigration and the like. That's part of it, but it's also just the move into mainstream opinion columns and general policy reports and things like that, things which in the past would have seemed quite outlandish, becoming quite normal. But I think that this might very well be an artifact of election season. And one of the great hopes would be that you see the American people and the American policy community as a whole looking at this and taking a step back and realizing what a strategic disaster it would be to fall into that trap of conflating Islam with these small extremist groups.
Let me ask you a question about another narrative, not conflating Islam with these radical groups, but conflating these radical groups with individuals who, as we've read, manage to self-radicalize. Because ISIS is actually losing ground and slowly losing in the field, they are resorting to exhorting their followers around the world to basically freelance.
When these people go and commit these mass atrocities and they don't associate themselves with ISIS or with Al-Qaeda, the media forgets about them almost immediately, almost as if it never happened. When there's this claim of association with ISIS, it becomes front page news and dominates the political landscape for weeks. Now, that doesn't mean, though, that there aren't any links. In other words, both of those things can be true.
You said at the beginning of this conversation that we should avoid the phrase radical Islam not as a matter of political correctness, but because that is precisely the narrative of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, who are intentionally trying to eliminate what you call the gray zones of tolerance, where essentially we can all get along. What do we call it, if not radical Islam?
You know, a better phrase is one that the Obama administration has been using for quite some time. I mean, these are violent extremists, very much outside of the mainstream, using violence to promote their message. And focusing on their violence and their extremism makes a lot more sense than trying to force this into an association with Islam, which has all of these negative repercussions. So frankly, I would simply call this violent extremism, because that's what it is.
Mark, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke.
Mark Lynch is a professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University and author of the new book, The New Arab Wars.
Coming up, why the Second Amendment may not mean what you think it means.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. That Orlando shooter, twice scrutinized by the FBI, legally purchased a high-powered assault rifle before his attack. That left an opening for pro-gun control legislators. By Wednesday, Democratic Senator Christopher Murphy had launched a 15-hour filibuster aimed at passing some modicum of gun regulation.
Then ask yourself, what can you do to make sure that Orlando or Sandy Hook never, ever happens again? With deep gratitude to all those who have endured this very, very late night, I yield the floor.
The late-night marathon forced Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to allow an upcoming vote on a bill to expand background checks and prohibit people on the FBI's no-fly list and other terrorist watch lists from purchasing guns. But even this small step in the direction of gun control may be tough to take, because civil libertarians have long found the no-fly list both opaque and possibly unconstitutional. And, as it happens, so does the NRA.
The NRA firing back with a response saying that their terrorists should not be allowed to purchase weapons, period, but then adding that they're concerned about the due process rights of Americans who are put on that watch list.
Of course, these days, the biggest impediment to any kind of gun control is the Second Amendment. But it wasn't ever thus. Writing in Slate this week, Dahlia Lithwick called the current interpretation of the Second Amendment, that it protects an individual's right to bear arms, a triple-decker hoax. The Second Amendment reads, a well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed. The key issue here is a matter of grammatical interpretation. Does it protect the rights of state militias or those of the individual?
Which is the operative clause in here? Certainly, it seems that you can't completely imagine away the clause that talks about the regulated militia and the clause about the right of the people are both clearly in operation.
It's going to be hard to resolve because the sentence simply doesn't scan. The first comma makes no grammatical sense. it leaves four oddly disconnected clauses and therefore ambiguity.
And it is true, Bob, that that comma has sent many Second Amendment scholars to their brandy. The way this sentence spools out is incredibly complicating. It does not make for simple parsing.
But ambiguity or no, the Republic did manage for more than 150 years to get by before anyone began to assert individual gun rights. How did that notion first surface?
Let's be clear. I think it was always ambiguous. So when this does, in fact, come in the landmark case in 1939, in a case called Miller that upheld a conviction for two men convicted of moving around short-barreled shotguns, the court looks at their claim that, hey, we have an individual right under the Second Amendment, and just bats it away and says, there is no Second Amendment right here. End of story. That's Miller in 1939, and that's good law for decades.
But at some point in the 80s, gun rights as an issue, and a very polarizing one, began to go mainstream. How did that become a thing?
Very, very powerful gun groups got together and started to organize around the proposition that there is this inherent individual Second Amendment right protected in the Bill of Rights. And this campaign to persuade people is, in fact, dovetailing perfectly with sort of fundamental American notions about freedom and liberty and the West. And so they actually have a fairly easy time selling to the American public the notion that the document contains something that it does not explicitly contain, and that is written in the Second Amendment. That first clause disappears, the second clause is everything. People have an individual right to bear arms.
The NRA may or may not have had a solid constitutional argument, but they did have a large pot of money, and with that money, cowed or maybe bribed legislators in state house after state house across the country away from gun control laws and even actually stymied government tabulation of gun crimes. But the crowning achievement of the NRA has to be 2008 and the Heller decision. Can you tell me about it?
It makes the wish come true. By a 5-4 margin, with Justice Antonin Scalia famously writing the majority opinion, the court concludes for the first time that there is an individual right to own and have a gun in your own home. And so this is both a watershed moment in that it changes everything, but in a strange way, I think it carries the imprimatur of something that is destined to be and always was.
Now, this gets to Heller's effect on the national conversation, the notion that the Second Amendment is not only a constitutional individual right, but that it's somehow subject to zero regulation.
Requiring gun registration with the federal government, that's an illegal abuse of privacy and freedom unprecedented in our history.
Even Justice Scalia, in the blockbuster opinion that he writes, says, of course, you know, regulations are okay. He lists places, you know, government buildings, schools. So in the face of the text itself, he's saying some regulation is obviously okay. What he doesn't do is tell us what the standard is. But there's no question, I think, on any side of the debate that some regulation is always going to be okay, even after Heller.
The late Justice Scalia's failure to be specific has left a gaping hole, and it's also made way for the idea, now commonplace, that liberals and the media were all coming for your guns.
And this is the part that's hard. This is the part that, you know, gets us angry tweets, Bob, and angry mail. And that is, I think that there is a large and effective campaign on the part of the NRA and other groups to really reinforce the idea that absent any regulation evincing such an intent, Barack Obama is coming for your guns, and so is Hillary Clinton.
Well, I make the same thing during the campaign when he said to people, I will not take away your rifle, shotgun, handgun. They leafleted the country with flyers like this, Obama is not going to take your gun. And now he's trying to take away all three.
That has been messaged so effectively that this is simply true for an enormous portion of the population.
Well, it may be propaganda, but in it resides, I guess, some element of the truth, because I don't think the liberals are out to confiscate anybody's guns. But in the event that Trump is not elected president, it's a dead certainty that a Supreme Court composed of Hillary Clinton appointees will come after Heller at the first opportunity. Is Heller, in a Hillary Clinton world, a short-time proposition?
It's a good question. I mean, one of the fights that the justices who actually wrote Inhaler had was how carefully you have to not upset the apple cart. One of the things Justice Stevens said was, you know, Miller from 1939, that's good law. People relied on that. You can't just set it cattywampus because you think it's wrong. So I do think that how it may get chipped away is the same way Roe v. Wade has been chipped away, which is Hillary Clinton will probably see a nominee willing to say, okay, let's give some force to the proposition that we can regulate. And I think that's how we're going to see it happen, exactly the way regulations are what started to eat away at the core holding of Roe v. Wade.
I also observed kind of glibly that we got through 150 years of the Republic without rethinking the Second Amendment, and we did just fine. But you could equally say we got through 150 years of the Republic with segregation and lack of women's suffrage and a whole bunch of other things that we as a society have rethought. So I guess we can't dismiss the Second Amendment question purely on the basis of us as a society only having just addressed it, right?
That's right. And I think in one way that goes to the fundamental distinction between conservative and liberal interpretation of the Constitution. The project in Heller was to look at this from an originalist perspective. What did the framers want? The fact that even liberal justices did that is kind of the cherry on top. It showed a total win for Scalia's worldview of originalism. But if you think about how progressives think about the Constitution, they're not necessarily wedded to the notion that we have to handcuff ourselves to the framers. And so I think in some sense, liberals are simply more comfortable with the notion that when we talk about guns, we don't have to talk about muskets. We can talk about AR-15s as well.
As long as I'm playing devil's advocate, I may as well also point out that one of the other most polarizing questions that the society has faced over the past 40 or 50 years is abortion. And Roe v. Wade is built on at least as gossamer-like a legal infrastructure as Heller versus Washington, D.C., no?
I think that's right. And a lot of liberal professors have spent a lot of time in the intervening years trying to think of ways to rewrite Roe so that it is on firmer constitutional footing. But I think in a sense, because they're more willing to live with an evolving document, it's much, much less of a migraine for liberals than it is for conservatives.
All right, then. So what happens?
I think part of what happens, Bob, is we enter the fight about Merrick Garland with a renewed understanding that the future of Heller is one of the things that a court is going to have to look at. And I think that we really have to, as a nation, put aside and somehow disaggregate our fury over this issue from the facts on the ground. There is a Second Amendment. It protects something, although we're not quite sure what it is. But it absolutely allows for regulation, and that's where the conversation should stop. It should not stop at the word there is a Second Amendment.
Dahlia, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate and hosts the podcast Amicus.
So far, we've spent the show awash in the issues raised by Orlando, the competing narratives, the calls to action, the policy solutions proposed to ensure that this never happens again. But in the New Republic this week, Jacob Bachrach urged us to take a cool actuarial position on the attacks, quote, that they will be relatively rare, but that they cannot be stopped entirely by more police, metal detectors, intelligence sharing, vague strength, gun registries, invasions, drone strikes, or, God forbid, internment camps and deportations. He compared mass shootings to natural disasters and suggests that it might serve us better to treat them that way.
Accepting the fact that hurricanes are inevitable doesn't mean that we shouldn't build the levees higher, and doesn't mean that we shouldn't have a political conversation about policies that may mitigate climate change. So inevitability can coexist with political action. I think that one of our problems is that we seek these ultimate and universal solutions whereby if only we banned assault weapons, if only we ceased aggressive wars in the Middle East, if only we fully accepted LGBT people, then we would no longer suffer these sorts of massacres. Well, in any of those cases, we could see a mitigating effect. But do I believe that we can so change ourselves and our culture that we will not ever face that type of violence? No, I don't. I don't think that it's healthy for us as a society to see that as the goal of this political conversation. We need to have a more holistic and humane conversation about who perpetrates these acts and what they mean.
I mean, how does that get us any further than political discussions? How do you have these discussions?
There is a place of politics which exists outside of the sort of ever-present left-right Democrat-Republican tussle, in large part within our communities. I think that you see something much more productive when you look at the conversations that are taking place between municipal leaders in a city like Orlando. If you look at the political activism that overtook the post-Orlando vigil in New York City, where you had elected officials, in effect, being shouted down by people who were saying, you know, this is not the conversation we want. That is an actual real locus of political action that exists outside of electoral politics. And I think that we do ourselves a disservice to say, well, that doesn't really accomplish anything, though, because it doesn't result in legislation.
Politicians often offer thoughts and prayers on Twitter after a mass shooting happens. There's one Twitter gadfly named Igor Volsky who comes after each one of these politicians and says, all you get are his thoughts and prayers because he got $50,000 from the NRA or something like that. You make a case for thoughts and prayers.
I may be the only self-described atheist in America who's making an affirmative case for thoughts and prayers. I actually believe that there is a real value in the ritual affirmation of togetherness. My younger brother died in his 20s after a long struggle with drug addiction. And after that happened, a lot of people who I barely knew expressed their thoughts and feelings on Facebook or by sending cards or by sending flowers, and some people who I didn't know at all. Did that take away the loss? No. Did it make me feel better? No, not really. But did I, in a way, appreciate it and ultimately come to believe that it had great value and that it demonstrated something important about those people, about their willingness to empathize? Yes. And I think that empathy is the root of political progress and social reconciliation. So in that regard, I do believe that there is a value to those sorts of ritual affirmations of feeling.
Even if they're sent by people who are, say, stridently anti-gay rights, like, you know, Ted Cruz. Do you want his thoughts and prayers?
Do I want his thoughts and prayers? No. But do I feel this intense need to reject them simply because they are undergirded by a kind of hypocrisy? No, I don't feel that either. Nor do I think that the hypocrisy underlying it necessarily negates its value even to a person like that. I mean, I think that the broad expression thereof is more valuable than each of those individual instances.
You wrote that as a culture, our duty is to decide if at each new incident we again crank the ratchet towards more surveillance, more jails, more police, more war, and more fear, or if instead we'll do the killers the great disservice of forgetting their faces and forgetting their names. If we decide not to ratchet towards more surveillance, war, fear, etc., and we do the killers the dishonor of forgetting their faces and names, what do we accomplish?
If the only thing that were to come out of this event were that America were to reevaluate the FDA's ban on sexually active gay men giving blood, then I would consider us as a society to have made a tremendous step towards being a better people. On the flip side of that, you know, you see Hillary Clinton and the Democrats immediately rushing and saying, well, you know what we're going to do? We're going to take the FBI's no-fly watch list and terror watch list, and we're going to prevent those people from buying guns. I mean, I am a person who believes that some greater degree of control on guns would be good for our society. But these FBI watch lists are arbitrary, extrajudicial, deeply flawed, impossible to get off of, with no transparency. So using that as the basis for what is proposed as this sort of progressive political solution is just a terrible thing. There is a way that we can use limited politics to become a much better people and a better country without constantly moving in this direction of a more militarized and more police-prone society where the reaction to every violent and terrible incident is to appeal to the sort of theater of security.
But if you urge us toward a kind of acceptance, a dwelling in grief, even a conscious inaction, which I think you do, then where does that leave us?
These events are so immensely complicated, and the perpetrators and their motives are so immensely complicated. And I think to seek that sort of, I like to call it the prosecutorial impulse, the desire to put something into a singular narrative for the purpose of arriving at a kind of prescription for how to punish, how to prevent, and how to move forward, that may be appropriate for certain politicians, but for a sort of national conversation such as it exists, it's not enough. We need to think harder and longer about the array of questions that we should be asking. I think we have to allow ourselves to continue to be confused, to struggle towards the notion of betterment. I think that there can be betterment, but I think that we do not find it, and we cannot find it by evoking a false sense of certainty or a false sureness of belief.
And what's the risk if we do?
The risk if we do is we invade another country. The risk if we do is that we round people up and put them into camps. There are terrible risks if we do. We have a real social predisposition to think that inaction is the worst possible outcome. Well, a thoughtful inaction, as frustrating and horrible as it can be after something as terrible as 100 people being shot, there are much more terrible things that we could do if we permit ourselves to be lashed to the belief that we must, in the most draconian way possible, prevent such things from ever occurring again. There are cures that are worse than this particularly American disease.
Jacob, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Brooke.
Jacob Bachrach is a writer based in Pittsburgh and author of the novel The Bend of the World. His commentary in The New Republic is called When Forgetting is the Proper Response to Terrorism.
Coming up, Brexit in the minds and the media of the British people.
This is On the Media.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, ones tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Thursday, we witnessed another act of violence fraught with associations, the murder of British Labour MP Joe Cox. Cox was an advocate for human rights and a staunch defender of refugees. Her attacker, a reportedly unstable right-wing nationalist sympathizer. Her murder, the first killing of a sitting member of parliament in 26 years. It happened exactly 1 week before a controversial referendum on what is known as Brexit, the question of whether Britain will leave or remain in the European Union. The murder prompted a brief halt to the campaigns for and against Brexit. The pro-Brexit side seems to have a slight lead, leaving those opposed scrambling to make the case for remaining in the EU. The International Monetary Fund, the Bank of England, and the UK Treasury have all come out warning of the economic dangers of a potential Brexit. Christine Lagarde, managing director of the IMF, says that
depending on what hypotheticals you take, is going to be pretty bad to very, very bad.
Indeed, fear of another recession is what the Remain camp is campaigning on. But Mark Blythe, professor of political economy at Brown University and co-editor of The Future of the Euro, says that it is the British psyche, not economics, that is at the heart of Brexit.
The arguments for Brexit is that the bureaucracy of Europe has grown into this behemoth which is overriding national parliaments and eroding national democracy. Let's regain control and then we'll be able to settle our own destiny. But the arguments against it focus on the cost of exit. They tend to sing one song, and that one song is it's going to go from very bad to very, very bad. The positive argument is fear, and the negative argument is hope. And once you get into that position, it's a bit like Trump saying, let's make America great again.
One of the most, I would say, demagogic arguments for leaving the EU is the accusation that because the EU is dominated by Germany, this is really just an extension of Nazism and the German desire to control Europe. That argument was made by former mayor of London, Boris Johnson.
Out on the campaign trail, Boris Johnson makes the most of every photo opportunity to press his case for leaving the European Union. The classical scholar said the last 2,000 years of European history had seen doomed attempts to recreate the Roman Empire by trying to unify it. Napoleon, Hitler, various people tried this out, and it ends tragically. The EU is an attempt to do this by different methods.
Think about how this whole referenda came up. David Cameron takes over the Conservative Party in Britain at a time when it has this Eurosceptic wing, and he wants to silence it once and for all. So he says, let's have a vote. Nobody's going to vote to get out. This is in 2010. Then Europe goes into an economic nosedive that it makes worse with austerity policies. And suddenly the EU looks awful, and it looks German-dominated. So this whole thing actually has a lot more to do with domestic politics in Britain than it has to do with any real debate about costs and benefits.
And in addition to the economic nosedive, there has been this immigration crisis.
Oh, that's absolutely the case. So the whole conjuncture of economic disaster in the Eurozone itself and then the migration crisis coming from countries as diverse as Syria and Afghanistan, that's what's brought this to the top of the agenda.
The fear of loss of sovereignty, the fear of loss of national character to a bunch of pushy bureaucrats in Brussels.
And I would go even further than that. Let's think about a couple of examples. So we've got Trump just now. So Trump is basically the fact-free politician, and he's locked up the Republican nomination. What we're seeing in election after election, we saw it in Austria just a couple of weeks ago, the far right nearly winning, is a general revolt against elites. And they're using the ballot box to express their displeasure. The political parties of the left and the right in Europe and in the US have basically said, hey, globalization's good for you. Don't worry about those jobs moving abroad because there'll be other ones and you'll be more highly skilled. And it's turned out that a large number of people have figured out that that was kind of phony. Whether you see it in Occupy Wall Street, whether you see it in Corbyn, you see it in Syriza in Greece, you see it in the support for the National Front in France on the right, they want to withdraw from the euro. There's a general rejection here of elites telling people what to do.
The question is, and let's just say it is not an insane reaction to believe we've been sold a bill of goods, is withdrawing from the EU a rational reaction to that? Doesn't this fall very much squarely into the category of cutting off your own nose to spite your face?
I think that's the case, but, you know, I'm a member of the elite, so why would anybody want to listen to me on this one? Let's put this in a deeper historical context. Whenever markets have really let rip in societies or across the world, when we've had periods when states have been in retreat and markets have been at the front, the people who are most affected by this end up basically trying to take over the state in order to protect themselves. Now, whether we call this nationalism, whether we call this socialism, whether we call this protectionism, it's all an attempt to basically wall out the outside to protect the community at home.
If the anti-Brexit forces are facing a fear of immigration, you know, there's a pretty strong argument, both historically and in the moment, for immigration. Have they not even bothered trying to make that?
It's kind of interesting that most of the migrants are still stuck in Greece. Hardly anyone's met them. If you took all 2 million refugees from the Syrian and Iraq crises and put them in Europe, if you spread them around easily, they'd be hard to find. So the politics of this are really weird. Take a country like Germany. Germany's very high pensions. People are living longer. So the replacement rate on the German population is 1.4. That means they're having 1.4 kids for every couple that's there. So if they don't have immigration, they shrink, they die, and they blow up their pension system. Yet it seems to be one of those things where even if the economic logic is impeccable for migration, simply because somebody needs to pay the taxes to pay your pensions, nobody wants to deal with it because it seems to be this awful flooding of the country with difference.
I want to ask you about the coverage. Historically, especially the heavily politically inflected British tabloids have not been shy about pandering to its constituencies to pour gasoline on the flames of discontent. And yet the coverage of Brexit does seem to be couched almost entirely in economic data and estimates of GDP and so forth, oddly circumspect from a Fleet Street anyway that's used to riling up the hoi polloi.
That's really interesting and really true. And I think it's because everyone's kind of conflicted. It's as if sort of the rational part of Fleet Street has said, well, hang on a minute. If at the end of the day this is going to really hurt and we're just going to renegotiate to get back in what we've already lost at a time when everyone's annoyed with us, why do it? But then the political side is very much, yeah, it's about Britain and it's about standing up to Brussels. And this is the story they've been telling their publics for 10 years. So they're kind of prisoners of what they've built themselves.
Mark, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Mark Blythe is a professor of political economy at Brown University and co-editor of The Future of the Euro. David Cameron's bugging me. Corbyn just sits there and agrees. What Tony Blair thinks it's funny. He's the master of deceit. We don't know how they spend our money. So we gotta start agreeing. Are we Brits or you? That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Dasha Lizitsina. We had more help from Micah Loewinger, Emma Stelter, and Isabel Christo. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Holford.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter's WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. Guess it's time for us to go.